21st century, Remy the Rat. Over the following months, hundreds of other composers, designers, choreographers, and actors posted their own TikTok contributions to create the first crowdsourced global musical theater phenomenon, Ratatouille the Musical.
But I've never posted a single TikTok. It's not my medium. Twitter prized information and wit. Instagram is about aesthetics. TikTok, theater kid energy. I don't have theater kid energy. I'm a better writer than I am a performer. Now, Rob Ford, so long as someone else was actually making the videos, he would have rocked TikTok. I'm not sure that would have been a good thing, but it would have been undoubtedly entertaining. And even where TikTok is right now, it's also pretty easy to see what it will look like as the junkiest content continues to move in from the edges to the center. I'd like to think it's time for a new paradigm. And that's why I'm on Mastodon. No, I'm kidding. I'm not sure what's next. But I'm reasonably confident that it shouldn't be more of the ever-worsening same. Perhaps anyone who leaves Twitter no longer needs it, and anyone who stays there does.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. You can sign up for our excellent newsletter there. Jonathan Goldsby wrote this episode. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Demi-Lila Onime, host of the International Cash Cows podcast, former producer of Wag the Dog, and newly minted Calgarian. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks, Jono. How are you?
I am glad you're here. Today on the show, from cash cows to puppy mills, or from victims to scapegoats, has there been a change in how we talk about international students? Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Ottawa has unveiled a cap on the number of international students allowed into Canada.
The feds say more students have been arriving in Canada without the proper supports.
It comes as the federal government faces criticism for increasing immigration numbers while the country faces a housing crisis.
It is not the intention of this program to have sham commerce degrees or business degrees that are sitting on top of a massage parlor that someone doesn't even go to.
Tens of thousands of students to come and go to fake colleges that the Liberal government now admits were, quote, puppy mills.
Well, Mark Miller didn't say they were puppy mills exactly. He said,
there are, in provinces, the diploma equivalent of puppy mills that are just churning out diplomas. And this is not a legitimate student experience. There is fraud and abuse, and it needs to end.
Which suggests to me he wasn't previously familiar with or aware of the term diploma mills. That's a term that's used. But I think him talking about predatory institutions as like puppy mills was the first time I've heard that metaphor used about this. But even with regard to, you know, more legitimate post-secondary institutions, the term cash cow in reference to international students and how they take advantage of them, has been used a lot. You know, as government subsidies for universities and colleges have shrunk, those institutions have increasingly turned to international students to make up the shortfall. You know, because while tuition is regulated for domestic students, schools can charge people from abroad pretty much whatever they want, whatever they think the market will bear, which works out to a lot more. And, you know, it's rare actually to find a feature story about international students in Canada that doesn't use the term cash cows, often in the headline. Just last week, there was Cash Cows and Cheap Labor, the Plight of International Students in the TAI. And in news reports over just the past few days, per the Winnipeg Free Press, students feel like cash cows, unfairly blamed for Manitoba's economic issues. And, you know, different advocates who spoke to CBC Calgary and CTV Ottawa bemoaned that their respective provincial governments treated international students as cash cows. I mean, Dami, your story, you did a piece for us for the Monday show for Canadaland a couple years ago called, I believe, Canada's International Cash Cows. Mm-hmm. And you now have a podcast series called International Cash Cows. You yourself were an international student. When did you first hear that term?
I first heard the term, I believe, close to the end of my studies. I got caught up in the pandemic. Before the pandemic happened, when I arrived very quickly, like I said in the piece that I did for the Monday show a few years ago, when I arrived in Canada, of course, I quickly started to experience a lot of the challenges that a lot of international students, and not only international students, a lot of immigrants face in the country, you know, trying to essentially make a home for yourself in a new place. I still have no family here. So, of course, it was very challenging for me. So I turned to the media as a journalist. You know, I wanted to see, why am I going through this? Plus, there were so many students in my class who were also international students. I believe we were 21 in my class, and there were only 5 or 6 domestic students. A lot of the other international students going through the same challenges that I was going through. So I went to the media. I couldn't find any of the stories. So I started to do them. A lot of my assignments in school, I did them on the issues, you know, some of the challenges, also the successes that international students were recording at the time. And that's kind of when, and then, you know, getting closer to the end of my studies. And, you know, of course, there were so many financial challenges that post-secondary institutions were facing during the pandemic, with students not being able to come into the country, international students, I mean, not being able to come into the country, you know, because of all the lockdowns and everything and the restrictions. And even with that, they were still increasing international student fees. I'm taking my courses online, doing, I mean, at the time, it was no fault of anyone, but then you're still charging me $8,000, $9,000, and you're charging domestic students, what, $1,500, $2,000 at the time? That's kind of when I started to hear about the term cash cows, so I dug into it.
If this is something the media has tracked for years, we know it's an issue. What has caused it to change recently? What has caused this shift in the narrative from international students being cash cows or victims or exploited to them coming to take our homes? I mean, with the increase in discussions about housing, I mean, we've been seeing housing in general, we've been seeing a lot more headlines, a lot more, you know, rhetoric linking it to immigration, but particularly a lot more headlines linking it to immigration, including a Canadian Press story from just a couple of weeks ago that originally went out over the wire with the headline, "Government was warned 2 years ago that high immigration could affect housing costs," or a Globe and Mail story also from earlier this month, was a couple weeks ago, "Canada stuck in population trap, needs to reduce immigration," bank economists say, with this focus shifting on the Canada being unable to sort of keep up with itself, needs to, maybe there are too many immigrants, which, as we'll talk about, is not really, you know, maybe in the top 5, top 10 ways to address the underlying causes of the actual major issues that we face.
There are a lot of immigrants. I'm one. But they are needed. The immigrants are needed. And I also feel like one of the reasons why it's not being talked about more is a lot more immigrants are speaking up. And I feel like they are more people in the media who are also these immigrants who are also now talking about the stories, right? And they're not only talking about them, but they're talking about the stories from the lived person's experience, which I think is also very, very important and valuable. So I feel like, you know, that's why we're hearing about it a lot more than we used to.
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent point. I mean, we're talking about all this system and series of systems and stacked systems that chances are, if you're born here, probably never had to give a moment's thought to, but which do affect at least hundreds of thousands of people in Canada every single year and are such a crucial part of this government and what our society does and how it treats people. Hopefully now that we have, now that there are more people, hopefully more people who have gone through these systems or do have this experience, who are better positioned, should say, to tell these stories in mainstream forms, is being brought to the fore more. And maybe outlets, publications are like ours are better able to tackle or come around to seeing systems that the people who previously worked here may not have had firsthand experience with. Like maybe there's definitely been a lot written in the past several years in particular about this. The earliest reference I found of post-secondary students, international students in Canada as cash cows, was a whole bunch of things in the fall of 2003, including a syndicated CanWest story that raised questions about. So Maclean's magazine does an annual university rankings. And one of the things it asked about was like, well, universities earn extra points in their rankings when they attract international students, but some argue this may reflect an institution's financial strategy rather than academic prowess. Since foreign students pay extraordinarily high tuition fees, they are often called cash cows. Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's a euphemism for exploitation. Do you think it's being addressed now?
No. I mean, maybe to an extent, it is being addressed, but also, I don't know. I felt like a cash cow when I was an international student. As soon as I realized that, I was paying 4 or 5 times more than domestic students. And anyone would say, yeah, but domestic students have paid taxes. Their parents have paid taxes from time immemorial. From the minute I stepped into this country, I started to pay taxes, right? I've gone through a lot of the things that, Canadians, the domestic students have gone through. Now, I agree that, maybe education is subsidized for domestic students, and other people will say, oh, maybe you should have stayed in your country. But at the end of the day, I'm bringing in money into the country. I'm bringing my skills. I'm helping to fill the labor shortage. They say that Canadians are now in the mortality age. I don't know how they say that, but, the workforce is now, mostly in the, mortality age. And now, they need people to come into the country. But I've been doing everything that most Canadians do. I'm, working, contributing to the economy. I bring my diverse skills and my experiences. I've been traumatized just because of, just because of my immigration experience and things like that. So I'd say I'm not sure that it is being, addressed. Mm. If it's going to be addressed, first we have to start with making sure that, the education system is prepared to actually provide an actual education for the people that, and not only international students, also domestic students. Because I just feel like it's been tackled, but it's not necessarily being tackled in the right way. The cap on international study permits that was announced this week, which is part of the reasons why, it's also, Jono, it's also when they make all these announcements. So like then there's a boom, everyone is talking about it, and then it dies again. And nobody is talking about it. And then the institutions can continue to hike the fees. Imagine public-private partnerships where a university or a college, a public institution will partner with a private institution and shove international students in some strip mall and call that an international education. Oh, yeah. I remember that you guys did an episode on it on Wag the Dog.
Yes.
So we just walked around in a circle in an office park in the Don Mills and Lawrence area of Midtown Toronto. And we were just coming to check out a satellite campus, which is a private college. And it is one of many of these in the GTA. It couldn't be more tucked away from city life. It is down a long one-way street amid a bunch of other...
It's a two-way street, otherwise we won't be able to get out of here.
You shove them in a strip mall or you shove them in some conference center. give them a shoddy education, and you charge them $9,000 for a for 4 months of that kind of studies. How is that even an education? People are coming into this country, putting their lives at risk, you know, taking out huge loans to come into the country for an education. Now, again, somebody else is going to say that, but yeah, nobody asked you to take out a loan or, you know, take out a second mortgage or whatever. But at the end of the day, I give people the benefit of the doubt that not everyone is coming to take advantage of the system. Some people actually just want the good education. I wanted the education, right? It's part of the reasons why I came here. But I mean, at the time when I came in 2019, it was presented to me as, okay, like, you come to Canada, and this is how I remember the episode I did for Canada Land. You know, when you dig more into it, when I came, it was presented to me like, you come here, you apply for a study permit, you get a study permit, you come here, you pay for the 2 years, 3 years, whatever, you know, for the diploma, and then we would allow you to stay. If you do everything right, we will let you stay and we will let you build a life here, right? So you cannot present that kind of opportunity. And then when people take advantage, and this is like taking advantage of it, like just taking advantage of it. And then you say, oh, no. You don't have a right to do that. I remember a story that broke a few months ago where they realized that there were over 700 students who had come from a particular country and all of them have come on, you know, study permits. How can things like that even be happening? And now to fix that, we're putting a cap. We're putting a cap on the number of international students that can come into the country. But then what's that cap going to do? Nobody is saying anything about how, especially, I mean, this is really targeting the colleges because that's where mm-hmm. a lot of international students go.
And you went to Seneca College, right?
Yes.
And you were in the Seneca campus proper, right?
Of course. Of course. That would have been my lead story that I was shoved in some strip mall. But, you know, nobody is saying anything about where these post-secondary institutions who are now facing a huge, you know, shortage of funds, where are they going to get that money from? Because they have to get that money from somewhere. They're not just putting that money in the bank account. They're spending that money. They're probably using it to pay for the professors. They're using it to, you know, upkeep of the institution and things like that. But nobody is saying where that money is going to come from. And now we're probably going to face another tax hike because that money has to come from somewhere.
That is a big part of the question is where if the governments aren't going to make up the short, like largely universities and colleges and especially colleges in large part turn toward international students. And, you know, because governments had not, you know, because their spending or their just inflation even like had basically outpaced
how much they
The government subsidies or government subsidies had been cut and they've been forced to turn to
international students,
other ways to cash cows to milk that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there one of the things you mentioned, I think it's one of the reasons that maybe this is coming up now. And it's, you know, for example, like I think for all the year you were a producer on Wag the Dog, you often wanted to do an episode of international students, though we did talk about it a bit. I don't think we ever ended up doing an episode. And it wasn't until this past summer, I think, when we did it because this policy that Doug Ford had put in place shortly after he came into office. So in 2019, this public college private partnerships, which he referred to, I think has basically sort of reached a tipping point and it became this incredibly acute example. And I think it's basically what Mark Miller is referring to with these puppy slash diploma mills. It's the case like in every province, I believe, where, you know, colleges and universities, you can go to them, you can get a post-study work permit afterwards and they can charge what they want. In Ontario, because of this change Doug Ford made in 2019, colleges were basically able to expand rapidly beyond their footprint by partnering with the private colleges, which are the sort of the strip mall colleges, which exist everywhere in Ontario, because if they partnered with a public college, they could basically pay the public college to get their curriculum materials, then teach those curriculum materials at their strip malls or whatever. And then the students who went through them would not only pay public college tuition, they would also get a public college diploma and therefore be eligible for a post-study permit to stay here. And that was not only uncapped, it was seemingly unregulated, and so essentially became a sideways route to just basically entirely unregulated second immigration system that was basically existed for no purpose other than to attract people with false promises to come here. And I think that's where it sort of like it just started to explode.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, Jonno, when people talk about it, they talk about it from the angle like it's the student's fault. When I'm in my country, Nigeria, I have no idea that, you know, that it's a private, public, whatever partnership. I'm applying to a school, but I have no idea. I mean, it's then like when you get here that you're figuring out things like that. You don't have this line of sight. You don't have this visibility when you're still like in your home country. And there's only so much research that you can do. You can't figure these things out. Also, let's not forget that, you know, there are immigration consultants and, you know, all these schools, they partner with consultants and whatever that help them get students. And those people just, they tell you whatever they think you want to hear just to get you here so that they can get their percentage.
I mean, one thing the federal government did do that I think everyone seems to agree is like the right move was the closing this sort of loophole in terms of these public college private partnerships will no longer lead to a post-study work permit.
I applaud that. Enough is enough with that. You can't have people paying exorbitant amounts for a degree that is not a degree.
And another thing you touched on, don't blame the students. I certainly hope people don't, but that's always a concern and a tension here, right? How do we discuss real issues of infrastructure and services that are struggling to keep up with a growing population, a growth that is mostly rooted in international migration, without wandering into or let alone leaving room for any of the obvious racist tropes? To be clear, international students are a marginal factor when it comes to housing affordability. If listeners want to learn more about what's actually driving this crisis, they can check out the deep dive on the latest episode of The Backbench. Demi, on this show, we like to duly note things. I will go first. Today, I would like to duly note the federal court's ruling on the federal government's use of the Emergencies Act. This ruling comes about 2 years after the federal government invoked it as sort of last-ditch measure to clear out the so-called convoy protesters in Ottawa. And the Mandatory Commission following the invocation of the act had found that actually the government was just barely had justified it. It was reasonable in the circumstances. It was an okay use of it. But separately, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and the Canadian Constitution Foundation challenged the act in court, or more or less they went to the court to sort of review the reasonableness to actually get a judicial opinion on it. And the judge, the ruling which came out earlier this week, determined actually the federal government wasn't in fact justified in invoking the Emergencies Act. The decision largely turned on this one particular question of threats to the security of Canada. Did the government meet that threshold and show, like, were there sufficient threats to the security of Canada under the accepted definition, which basically meant threats of serious violence? Was that met in order for it to be reasonable for them to bring in the act? And the judge basically found no. But I'm bringing this up because there was actually a really interesting paragraph at the start of the conclusion, which is not the sort of thing you don't often find it in judicial decisions. I mean, obviously, judicial decisions, judges talk about how they arrive at their opinion. That's it. Like how they, you know, how the arguments offered by both sides inform the opinion and how they use, you know, their reasoning and precedent to arrive at it. This one actually begins, he notes sort of what he actually thought and what his opinions were going into the case and how those changed and shifted. And yeah, that's not something you see very often. What he wrote was, at the outset of these proceedings, while I had not reached a decision on any of the four applications, I was leaning to the view that the decision to invoke the Emergencies Act was reasonable. I considered the events that occurred in Ottawa and other locations in January and February 2022 went beyond legitimate protest and reflected an unacceptable breakdown of our public order. I had and continue to have considerable sympathy for those in government who were confronted with the situation. Had I been at their tables at the time, I may have agreed that it was necessary to invoke the act. And then he basically says, well, he has the advantage of 20/20 hindsight now and more extensive record of the facts, and that's why he reached a different decision. But that, yeah, at the time he thought actually it was reasonable, and if he had been in the government's position, he probably also, or he may have also agreed it was reasonable. And it's only now looking in hindsight that he doesn't think it was. And I thought that was really a really interesting bit of honesty or transparency that you don't often see in judicial decisions.
Duly noted.
Demi, what would you like to duly note today?
In keeping with the theme of talking about immigration on this episode, I want to duly note an overlooked immigration story that I think merits a lot more discussion, and it's about the increasing trend of reverse immigration in Canada. Now, probably due to the surge in the cost of living and, you know, finding jobs, you know, it's really just really unaffordable to be in Canada now. And that is causing something that has been tagged reverse immigration. And what that means is people who come into the country as temporary residents, they become permanent residents, they are leaving the country in droves. In the first half of 2023, around 42,000 individuals left Canada. And that has, you know, there's been a significant number of departures in 2022 and 2021. There were a lot of newcomers who also left. When I was preparing this, yesterday I was thinking about it. The day I flew to, when I moved to Alberta, I went to Edmonton for a few weeks. The day I flew out of Ottawa, I met a lady at the airport and we just got to talking. And she was telling me how, of course, she was a newcomer. She had come here as a PR. She had stayed here for 2 years. She had a young son. And she said the last 2 years of her life, she doesn't even know what she's done. You know, that she has tried everything, you know, to find a stable job and just be, you know, try to be comfortable and, you know, just make a life. She had made her immigration reason for her child because she didn't really want her child to grow up in her home country because it wasn't really safe. And they have moved here. And just for the last 2 years, she had not been able to find a stable job. And she was saying, you know, she was comfortable in her home country. They were doing fine. It is expensive to become a citizen, especially think about like if you do the study permit route, you have paid what, $30,000, $40,000. That's if you go to a college, you're paying upwards of that if you go to a university, right? And then you have to do an English proficiency test. Even though I'm Nigerian, English is my first language. English is all we speak in Nigeria. English is all I have spoken. I had to do an English. I have done a 2-year diploma. I was taught in English all my life. I had to do an English proficiency test, which cost me $400. The price has probably gone up. I didn't need a lawyer to help me apply for anything.
But So the thought that people will go through all of this and then decide, f it, and just go back. Yeah.
I mean, because Jonathan, think about it. Like, if you can't find a place to live, you can't find a job, right? You go back home because, I mean, at the end of the day, it wasn't 10 years of nothing because, I mean, you have the permanent residency and no one can ever take that away from you except, you know, maybe you commit, you kill someone. I'm pretty sure there are ways where you can, you can lose your permanent residency, but you have that.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you know what? I'm sorry. Like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going back home. So that's one of the reasons why our permanent residents are no longer becoming citizens. And also, just like we were saying, the 10 years following your arrival are very crucial. You know, so they say that while fewer permanent residents are naturalizing overall, 92% of naturalizations take place within the first 10 years. Now, in other words, if a permanent resident chooses not to become a Canadian citizen within that first 10 years, they, you know, they're just like, you know what? I'm going to stick with my permanent residency and that's it. And yeah, I think it's very important for Canadians and even newcomers to know this because, you know, it will just give us that visibility into what the process is like. And also maybe it will stop this conversation of newcomers are the ones taking all the jobs. Mm-hmm. Newcomers are the ones causing the housing shortage. Newcomers are the reasons why the healthcare is in complete shambles. Newcomers don't want to become Canadian citizens.
Yeah, that's a very useful perspective check. Thank you. Duly noted. That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks so much for joining me, Dami.
Thanks for having me, Jono.
Listeners can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com or find me on Blue Sky at Goldsby at something or other. I will try to read everything you send. Where can people find you, Dami?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Damilola Onime, O-N-I-M-E is the last name.
And they can also listen to your International Cash Cows podcast.
Thank you for plugging that in. Yeah, you can listen to the International Cash Cows podcast. We're working on season 2, but you can listen to all of the 5 episodes of season 1 wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. And theme music's by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.